Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
It's 3 minutes to midnight, and Madrid is over. Catherine is eating her Twiglets. And she's safely back in her apartment after spending a week presenting live television coverage of the tournament in Madrid. How's it been out of 10, Catherine?
Oh, better since I've had my Twiglets.
Yeah.
Do you mean my experience of it or my sort of objective assessment of the tournament's quality?
Oh, crikey. Can we have both?
Good. I mean, I would say the... What's our benchmark? What's our metric? You weren't expecting it. It's 10 out of 10, David. It's all been great. Yeah. Move on to Matt.
Is Miami the benchmark? Matt, what have you made of it? I've kind of, for quite a lot of the tournament, I told you on Thursday that I've just enjoyed it because I've just been sort of watching it without working on it other than recording the podcast. And I think that's meant that I've just been able to really soak it up.
Yeah, no, I think it's been good. I've had some issues with the scheduling, which I've found difficult to overcome. I really don't like the way they scheduled the tournament, front heavy for the women, and then sort of piling up all those important men's matches at the end. I thought the fact that the women's final was scheduled between the men's semifinals was not right, really. But a lot of good tennis was played, that's for sure.
Mm, yeah. A lot of different tennis as well because of its altitude, that tournament. I think that is one of the things that is going to be very interesting to follow over the next 2 or 3 weeks is whether any of the results that we've seen in Madrid feel relevant to what comes later. That's always been an issue, hasn't it? So let's start with that women's final because – I agree with you. It's a bit of a shame the way the scheduling ended up placing it in the tournament. But at the same time, that had such a big match feel to it. That felt Aryna Sabalenka against Ash Barty as the perfect final in a way because of all the build up, the fact that they've played several times. In the end, it was Aryna Sabalenka who won the title 6-love, 3-6, 6-4. Really took me aback that this was her 10th title. I had no idea that Aryna Sabalenka had won that many for a player who hasn't gone beyond the fourth round of a Grand Slam tournament. But Catherine, your assessment of what you saw from Sabalenka in that final, because I mean it was not straightforward, but it was quite a sight.
Yeah, well, first set was kind of exactly what you predicted, just breathtaking, bulldozing tennis, unplayable for this world number one, I think unplayable for any world number one in history. Just unplayable, that first set, 6-love to Sabalenka. And then...
What was she doing?
just hitting the ball very hard in all the right places. I mean, that's...
That'll usually get
That's what winning points is all about, isn't it?
There was one return which knocked Barty over.
Yeah. I mean,
I was driving at this point. Blimey.
Yeah. It was breathtaking stuff. It was make you gasp tennis. Except it wasn't even that surprising because that's the tennis she'd been playing all week. It was just surprising that it was the world number one down the other end of the court. And Barty just stayed so calm. She didn't panic about losing a set 6-love. She started slicing more, started manoeuvring and manipulating the ball a bit better, and she started making Sabalenka have doubts, have a bit of a wobble like she did in the latter stages against Pavlyuchenkova in the semi-final. And even a few weeks ago, I think Aryna Sabalenka would have lost that match from the point of being a set all, from the point of having won a set 6-love and probably thinking, well, this is easy. Title, here I come. Slightly weird glass vase trophy. They might as well start engraving it now. And suddenly she's a set all. And I think even a few weeks ago, it could all have got away from her from that point. And I'm so impressed that in that third set, she came out on top, and it wasn't in the same manner that she came out on top in the first. She didn't just bulldoze over Barty. She had to hang tough and be patient and be focused and wait for her opportunity. And these are not words that we associate with Aryna Sabalenka. So set one was kind of, although set one was the, might be what we remember that performance for, actually set three was the most important part of that performance. Set three is what will make Aryna Sabalenka a Grand Slam champion if she ends up becoming one. It won't be the bulldozing tennis, because she's kind of always had that. You know, we all at some point have predicted that she'd either win slams or reach finals on the basis of matches we'd seen her play where she just bulldozes people and looks unplayable. It was what we saw in set three that's new for me and that will take her to a level that we've not yet seen, I think.
I completely agree with that. I think of all the score lines that I might have predicted or expected, Sabalenka in three was probably the least likely for me. I thought it was possible she would bulldoze Barty in two. I thought it was possible she might not show up. She might have a shocker and Barty would win in two. I thought it was possible that if Barty extended it into a third set, she would be the one able to hang around and be gritty and able to win the match in three. So the fact that Sabalenka's won it in three was surprising to me and really impressive from her. Because as it happened, as you said, she did have to play brilliant, brilliant tennis with all of her firepower. But she also had to really compete. And we saw that in that third set. And we've speculated on Thursday's podcast, what can you do when Sabalenka is playing like that? Can Ash Barty do anything? And we got the answer in the first set that no, you can't. The answer is you cannot do anything to that tennis from Sabalenka. But I suppose what you can do is what Barty did, which is just stay completely focused, engaged in the match, keep your head, and be ready to pounce if the level does drop. And inevitably, it did a little bit. One unforced error from Sabalenka in the first set, 14 from her in the second set. So I think in many respects, Barty probably played the match she was hoping to play. She was calm. She used that slice. She did disrupt Sabalenka a little bit. But there was always a part of the match which was out of her control. And the final stages of that match, Sabalenka had a surge, a Naomi Osaka-esque surge, where she won the last 11 points of the match. And there was kind of nothing Barty could do about it, which must be an uncomfortable feeling as the world number one. But it's kind of the reality of that incredible tennis that Sabalenka can play.
Little moments of graduation in that third set where she's just about hanging on because Barty's having the upper hand. I mean, that third set, Barty was the better player for the first half of it, and the score just wasn't showing that in terms of games. And it was quite interesting listening to the commentary. I think it was Sam Smith and Annabelle Croft talking about how exhausting it must be to be making that much emotional noise and that much effort, and every feeling you have is there for all to see on Sabalenka, whereas Barty's quietly going about her work down the other end and not expending all that energy. And it did start to make me wonder, well, I reckon there are matches in the past that she's just combusted in these situations and kind of either been made to beat herself or she has just capitulated. And on this occasion, she just about hung around long enough and has that ability to suddenly find it again and strike and forget it. She has a forget it game. You know, if she's on, there ain't much she can do, because it's not just power, it's direction. It's sometimes very, very difficult to predict which way she's going. That's another little thing she has in common with Osaka. I don't think it's quite as sorcerous in its angles, but I still don't know where the ball's going sometimes, and then it's just gone, you know. And Barty did a fantastic job to make that a good match, because she has been steamrolling really, really good players all week long, and that's I picked her to win the title halfway through that Kasatkina first round match, because Kasatkina is a good player, you know, and she was just making her look like a hacker.
Mm. Yep, you went there, David.
Well, I mean, look, I can't say I would have picked it from the draw. You know, it was just a feeling in that match. You know, had we been looking at the draw at the start of the match, I don't think I would have said Sabalenka's going to win the tournament at all. You know, and I think that's where you get the benefit of seeing these matches. But why are you looking at me like that, Catherine? What?
I've seen more gracious victories, put it that way.
David, a question for you.
Yeah, go on.
Does it make you feel differently about picking Sabalenka for slams? For example, the French Open. Because for me, I'm very aware of what you said at the start of this show. How relevant are the Madrid results going to be? Because the conditions are such an outlier there. But I think for me, I need to see her do it at a slam before I can pick her to do it at a slam, if that makes sense. That the pressure there is different, it's bigger, and she's not been beyond the fourth round, as you said. I mean, she's only pretty much lost to Serena, Muguruza, Barty this year, I think Kanepi once as well. And I've seen her be able to put this incredible tennis together now for several matches in a row, which I feel like she hasn't really done that before consistently, and she's doing that now. But If we're talking next level, for me, the slams, she still doesn't quite sit alongside the absolute favourites, because she'd have to come out of nowhere at those events. And it's been done, but I'm not going to pick it. But I don't know how you feel about that.
Can I give you a Matt-esque stat?
Please.
No player has ever reached the top five in the world without reaching a Grand Slam quarterfinal. And Sabalenka is now number four in the world as a result of her exploits this week.
You dropped that stat on Prime and I gasped. It was so good.
Oh, I assumed you'd given her that.
No, I have to correct Max. Max Prime's stat man in the gallery, who hopefully keys through to me in my ear all throughout the day with stats, hoping that I don't already have them. And every time I end up going, Matt gave me that. Yeah, I've got that. Yeah. And Matt's like, oh, you and your bloody superpower, Matt Roberts. And he finally had a killer stat that I didn't already have.
That's a belter. That is an incredible stat, isn't it? To answer your question, Matt, I mean, I would put still put the French Open as the fourth most likely breakthrough for her.
Oh, wow.
I don't
Wimbledon.
Yes. Yeah. I don't see her being the favourite for the French Open. I think it's such
have
a different.
Have you ever seen her play on grass, David? Are you doing a Sebi Korda?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Okay.
I think she didn't. She reach the final
Eastbourne.
Win Eastbourne. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think. Look, you, when she starts hitting those strokes, I always have Wuhan in mind when I think of her on a fast
Wuhan Bolden.
Yeah, I always think of her on a fast surface, and that's what she can do with it. So I think she's got more chance at the others.
But I had Wuhan in mind when I picked her to win the Australian Open 2 years ago. You know, we've all been burned.
But she's further down the line now. I mean,
yeah, no,
she's a better player.
I agree
now.
With both of you. I completely agree. I was completely swept up in her tennis. I think this is a significant and lasting step forward. I don't think this is a flash in the pan. But equally, until I see her do it, I might not be predicting her to do it because once bitten, twice shy. Although, Matt, you are always the one that when we have this discussion about Sabalenka, you point out that she's had some rough draws and she's actually lost to very good players a lot of the time in slams, sort of results that on paper, you know, second round, third round, don't look great. She's losing to very good players.
Yeah, I don't think she's had a really bad slam loss. And I think she's transferred that now to the tour. She's not losing unless she's, as I said, losing to Barty, Muguruza, Serena.
She's not losing to Kuzmova.
Well,
not many people are.
In doubles, though, it'd be different.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. That's what Matt meant all those years ago. He meant the doubles. Anyway. I would definitely put Barty ahead of her as in the pecking order for Roland Garros. I think Barty's right at the top there. I also think the court Philippe Chatrier is perfect for Ash Barty. Just think that really wide, big run off the backdrop and everything is perfect for her type of game. I don't know why, but it just feels like it is almost for Nadal, that opportunity for her to just spread the court. I don't think it's quite as easy to just blitz your way through somebody when they've got that much distance around the court to run into and get it back. I think the visuals for a player are different. There's a lot of factors there. But it's yet another fascinating ingredient that goes into these tournaments coming up over the next few months.
Where is Sabalenka in your order behind Barty?
I would think she's about fourth or fifth, something like that. You know, I think you'd have to put Simona Halep ahead. And I think Iga Świątek would be ahead, being the defending champion. She might squeak into fourth, but then I also think...
Would you put Muguruza ahead?
I would put Muguruza ahead, I think.
Fully fit, I think I would as well. And then I think, where do I put Serena Williams? Because she beat Sabalenka just a couple of months ago.
That increasingly looks like a great win, doesn't it?
Yeah. It was a really good win. And I think... My mind always goes back to that quote from Williams when the sudden realization of what she was faced with, and she just said, "Oh, you want to go power? Okay." And she just loved it. She loved that gauntlet being thrown down, but she recognized that she was up against somebody with similar firepower, even to her at her best. So it's going to just be really, really interesting. I think Ash Barty's canister, to use a bit of our recent parlance, is going to be interesting to witness as well, just to see whether there's any using up of her resources over the... Because, I mean, she's had a lot of tennis, and now she's playing Rome, I assume. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get on to Rome, but I think she's in Sabalenka's quarter. So they could meet for a fourth time in the last few weeks. Yeah, I mean, she doesn't strike me as someone who really pushes herself to the absolute brink when she plays. I feel like she's very aware of her energy levels and what she needs to win a match. But I agree, she is playing every week at the moment. It must be a factor, fatigue. I guess the 2 weeks between Rome and Roland Garros could end up helping her. She can play Rome, yeah. And she's got 2 weeks ahead of Roland Garros.
I don't think it's going to be a factor, personally. I think she looks fresh. She looks happy. Mm. She's so fit. I mean, what an athlete. As long as she doesn't get any injuries, I think she's just loving the challenges out there. And at the moment, there's still a freshness about her. So I think she'll be all right. And as you say, there's those built-in gaps.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports-ad-free. That's amazon.com/sports-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So, there we are, Aryna Sabalenka, the champion in Madrid, and a quite fantastic performance. She did a little dance at the end, which I don't know what that was in reference to, and I won't be trying to replicate it anytime soon.
It was an original.
Was it? Oh. Well, I liked
either that or something from TikTok.
Right. I don't have TikTok.
And then she very nearly had the trophy blasted out of her hands at the shock of the confetti cannon.
It does take you by surprise, doesn't it? Especially because you hear the bang first and then you're like, what the hell was that? And then you're, oh, there's the streamers.
I think if anything involving a cannon is happening in your proximity, you should be warned about it.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right. Any first-time winner there jumps up in the air. Rafael Nadal just sort of shrugs. But, anyway, he got knocked out long ago. On that subject of Nadal losing 6-4, 6-4, he lost to Alexander Zverev and then Dominic Thiem. What did you make of them before we get on to the people who played the final? Obviously, this event took place later than the women's tournament for all the reasons we've talked about in terms of the scheduling. So, but when we spoke on Thursday, I can't even remember if Nadal had played by then against Zverev. But I mean, no, I don't think he had he?
No.
Is there any cause for concern, Catherine, in what you saw from Nadal in Madrid in terms of his prospects for the next 2 or 3 weeks?
No, he wasn't very good. Definitely, it was his competitive animalistic spirit that made it less of a one-sided scoreline than it could have been. He really wasn't very good at all. He was dropping balls very short. His returns, I mean, look, I suppose in hindsight you could say, well, Zverev did it to everybody with his serve, you know, impossible to return, all the rest of it. But he was dropping returns incredibly short. And his slice wasn't having that much impact against Zverev. He just was far, far from his best, Nadal. But I really don't think he likes playing in Madrid very much at all. You know, I think he loved being...
He's his least successful of those.
Yeah, and I know he's won 5 titles. I sort of take one of those out of the equation because it was before it moved to clay. So 4 titles. That is obviously extraordinary. But by Nadal's standards, it's peanuts, isn't it? It's been relatively really unsuccessful for him over the years. I don't think he likes it there. Take away it being at home. Take away the fact that, and I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this, it felt like the first, like, it felt like the first event where crowds were really a feature. There really were crowds in Madrid. You heard them, you felt them, they affected things. And I think he loved that. But I think it was bad from Nadal, but I don't read too much into it for Roland Garros. Other than that, he could probably do with doing all right in Rome. You know, doesn't necessarily have to win it, but I do think he could do with not losing that early in Rome.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he started the match quite well against Zverev. He was 4-2 up, and then in his own words, he did a disaster.
Oh, this is such great words.
and it was uncharacteristic from Nadal that he would have a bad game and it would fester, but it did. And from that point on, his forehand was, as Catherine said, either dropping short or just spraying an unforced error. And it was strange for me. It did feel like a step back after the sort of progress he'd made in Barcelona and at the start of Madrid, where he looked like he was really confident again. But I do think there's something in that matchup against Zverev that is becoming quite an interesting head-to-head. Zverev's won their last 3, their last 6 sets. Nadal still leads the head-to-head 5-3, but if you dig down into that, even some of those wins were very hard fought. 5 sets at the Australian Open, saved a match point in Indian Wells, 3-set final in Rome where the rain intervened and sort of stopped Zverev's momentum. I think there's something in that matchup that Nadal doesn't like.
Is it Djokovician?
Well, exactly. One of the explanations I have is that Nadal loves to hit his forehand into right-hander's backhand. But that is playing directly into the Zverev strength in the same way that it is when he plays Djokovic. So it almost feels like it's one of those matches when Nadal has to adjust to his opponent rather than the opponent having to adjust to Nadal, which isn't so often the case. I think Zverev's wins recently have come in conditions which have favoured him, indoors and at altitude. So it'd be interesting if they play somewhere else. I believe they're in the same quarter in Rome, which I think would tell us a lot more about how that matchup could potentially unfold at Roland Garros, for example. But yeah, not a great week from Nadal, but it doesn't affect how I view his Roland Garros prospects. For team, I was quite disappointed by his performance in the semifinals. Certainly, while I was watching it, quite a lot of sloppy errors. He didn't feel like he really had a lot in him. He wasn't digging deep, did he? Never got going. But if I take a step back, I think it's understandable that he would have a setback after not playing for 6 or 7 weeks. And I think he wasn't too worried. I think he got what he wanted out of Madrid, possibly even more. And he's really viewing this as building towards Roland Garros. And, you know, I'm more positive about Dominic Thiem than I was before the week, because we saw him play some good tennis.
He was surprised he got as far as he did, didn't he? Wasn't he,
yeah.
Dominic Thiem? He wasn't expecting to reach the semis.
I wonder how much he needs from here to become a threat? Has he got enough time?
There's definitely time. It will be interesting to see what he does with his schedule. I mean, I think if he wins Rome, fine, he's set. If he loses, let's say he loses...
That's unlikely though, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm only saying that in that he's still rusty.
Semi-finals, final of Rome, he's fine. Let's say he goes out quarterfinals of Rome with another subpar performance. Could take a wild card into Geneva, something like that. You know, I could see him thinking, yeah, I'll sign myself up for some more matches, but I don't think he's going to be pulling the trigger on that before he sees how Rome pans out.
Yeah. I'm also mindful that he went into the US Open in no form at all. He got absolutely thrashed by Krajinovic in the Western Southern Open.
Yeah.
And then he used those early rounds of that tournament, which I think you can do a little bit more with the best of five sets and being seeded. I can't think of an unseeded player, potentially John Isner. If John Isner's unseeded, he's dropped out of the top 30. I don't know where he would be with the seedings, but there's not many unseeded players that I would think would cause team that many problems over five sets on clay. If he has a decent Rome, he might go to Lyon or Geneva, but even if he didn't, I think he can use those early rounds to build some confidence and some level on the clay.
I think he'll be fine. I do.
Yeah. He did well, actually, to get through Isner, the man you mentioned, because Isner really played some fabulous tennis in Madrid. He looked a real threat, didn't he, on that court, and won the first set against Thiem. And I thought he was going to take him out. I really did. And I actually think that's quite a credit to Thiem that he found a way through that, because there are moments when Isner's playing like that where the opponent is just kind of irrelevant. They don't. I think you said to me, Catherine, halfway through that match, I have no idea how well Dominic Thiem is playing, because he's not really being able to do anything. He can't get the ball back. He can't actually get. It's kind of like physically impossible for him to get to the serve. So how can we know whether he's playing any good or not?
Yeah, I can't imagine anything worse than playing John Isner. I mean, generally, but also your Dominic Thiem, you're on clay and at altitude. You know, Madrid is often compared to Indian Wells, isn't it, in terms of the way it plays, the ball sailing through the air. It's obviously the exact circumstances different, but the comparisons certainly are there. And Thiem won his first Masters title in Indian Wells, played some of his best tennis. You know, you've got clay beneath your feet and you're looking down the other end of court, you see a big lump of an American. And you might as well not be there. You're just trudging from side to side. I mean, it must just... Oh, what... Just awful. Just, yeah. I mean,
and ball's coming down at angles that you're just not used to.
Yeah. Look, I'm exaggerating for comedy effect. John Isner had a lot more to his game than just the serve in Madrid. It very much conditions assisted, I think. But he, I mean, we played a couple of interviews with him on Prime. He just had this spring in his step. He looked quicker in Madrid than I've ever seen him before. He obviously just gets out of bed at the crack of dawn and goes, I'm in Madrid, things are great. Like, he just loves it there, loves those conditions. Yeah, but... I thought that was a cracking performance from Thiem with so few matches under his belt to come through that one, because he could have just gone, oh, for goodness sake, screw this.
Forget this.
Yeah.
other half of the draw, Matteo Berrettini came all the way through to the final, which is not what I expected. I thought my man Casper Ruud would take him out, as we know. But he got done in the semi-finals. What a performance from Berrettini, Matt. I mean, he's won me over. We've talked about it a couple of times. I've sort of been won over by him as a bloke, because he just seems like a really nice fella. It comes across very well in interviews. And his game We'll talk about the final in a minute, but I mean, his game is really potent, and he's looks like there's actually room to grow yet further to me.
I've been trying to work out whether he's a much better player than I realized, or whether he's improved a lot. And I hope I've come down on the side that he's improved a lot, because it feels that way to me. His forehand I've always known about, but it seems even better. And more than anything, it seems like he's getting his forehand into play more. He's covering that backhand. I think the backhand's probably improved, but the way he gets his feet round it and brings his forehand into play is incredible. It is so, so good. He uses that as a weapon. And I think in all the matches I saw him play this week, he was the playmaker. He was the one dictating. He was the one setting the pace, trying to play it on his terms. And I loved watching that. And more than anything, he had this hunger about him this week. And I think a lot of that stemmed from the injury he suffered in Australia. I think he was really ready for this season and he was playing really well. And to be sort of struck down in his prime like that, I think hurt him and made him even more motivated to get back that positive feeling that he had and to put in the work. And he was a joy to watch this week. He really was.
Yeah, I didn't know Berrettini was this good, honestly. And I've had the same crisis as Matt. Was I just not paying attention, not making the right assessments, or has he got significantly better?
I think we thought he was a flash in the pan based on a couple of good weeks.
I said this on our chat earlier. I think I have quite a subconscious built-in snobbery about the forehand dominant, you know, big serve, big forehand style of play. Because I think it's to generalize massively, a bit out of date now, and these days it's not enough to get you to the very top of the game. There is nobody at the very top that has a glaring weakness. You know, with all due respect to Andy Roddick, I'd say he's probably the last player that reached number one, won Grand Slams, with a glaring weakness that he improved throughout the course of his career, but he was that template of player. And look, I loved watching Andy Roddick; he was one of my favourite players. But I do think, very generally, I've developed a snobbery about that style of game, and I had sort of filed him away in that category. And I suppose, very broadly, he is that. But he's an extremely superior version of that. And yeah, there's just so much more to him than I realized. I didn't know he had a sliced backhand like he showed us this week. I really didn't. Not just a rally ball, I don't want to hit my topspin forehand because it's not that good a shot, so I'll throw in a slice. A proper, I'm going to do you damage and make you really uncomfortable with this knifed low shot slice, a real weapon of a slice. And yeah, his footwork blew me away. I didn't know he was this good, and I didn't know he had this much hunger. And maybe that, I think it is partly pandemic and injury propelled, but whatever it is, I'm here for it. It's great.
Well, the thing with the pandemic is he made me feel like he had the appetite to improve when he did that Instagram live with Chris Evert. And she was just talking to him and his girlfriend, Ila Tomljanovic, and he just seemed so determined to try to make the best of it and to improve. And I was persuaded by him. But at the same time, I thought that I'm not sure how much you can improve. I didn't really know that what he's doing now was possible. So, you know, great credit to him. And he got those wins over first Christian Garin, who he had to come from behind in and win 11 games out of 12, I think it was, something like that.
11 games in a row.
11 games in a row in order to win that, which he did. He did a brilliant job. I mean, he's an interesting story. He's coached by Vincenzo Santapadre, a former player who was around when I was on the ATP circuit as a communications manager. I remember going to his dad's restaurant once in Rome. Blimey, hell, it's nice. Anyway, best restaurant I'd ever been to in my 20s. And his manager is Ivan Ljubicic, which is, you know, Ivan Ljubicic has got a management agency, which is all a bit strange because he's also Roger Federer's tennis coach, and he's not his manager. So, you know, exactly how it all works, I don't know. But I'm not that surprised that Ivan Ljubicic is somebody's manager and agent, because he was the first in line at the ATP University in 1998 to talk to the financial expert and get lots and lots of advice about all that. And he's always had his head screwed on like that. But I think Berrettini seems just like he's going in the right direction, as we've seen from his results. He's, what, 10 in the world, and he's made this final, and he's faced Alexander Zverev, and he led by a set to love. Cracking set of tennis, have to say. Tie break that he led 5-love, Berrettini. Eventually, it was pulled back to 5-4. He had set points, then Zverev had set points, and eventually Berrettini won it. But Zverev came back to win the match, and I sort of felt like, I don't know what you thought, my feeling generally was that experience won the day on that stage, in that Zverev wins these tournaments. He hasn't cracked it at slams, but he wins Masters 1000 tournaments. And what was that? His fourth one. I think he outlasted him, really. What did you think?
It strikes me that he has a style of play that he can fall back on, and it gets him through matches, even though he might not necessarily feel like the better player in them. As I said, Berrettini was the one dictating, the one who looked in position to win. But Zverev defended well, and he returned well, and he just made a lot of balls and kind of just stuck around, and in the end, kind of outlasted Berrettini, as you said. But I think Berrettini will have some regrets about that match. I thought he put it fantastically in the speech, where he said, "Tennis is a crazy sport. This should be a brilliant moment for me. This has been a big week in my career, but I lost, and I feel terrible. And yet, I kind of feel like I should be celebrating my first Masters final." I thought that was a really interesting perspective from Berrettini, and I think he felt like that because I think he knew that was on his racket. He was getting in position to win it, and he didn't quite execute. And Zverev was solid enough to take advantage.
Yeah, Daniela and Greg in the Prime studio were sort of looking on at that defeat for Berrettini as sort of wise elders, sort of nodding along, going, "This is a pain you have to go through in order to achieve in the future." They definitely shared your view, Matt, that he lost that match due to his inexperience. Zverev, I think, did a great job of falling back and exploiting his greater experience, of using that as a well of confidence. But that match was absolutely on Berrettini's racket, and I hope he was the playmaker out there, which, given the kind of tennis that Zverev had been playing all week, is pretty incredible. And I hope it does hurt, because hungry Berrettini, point to prove Berrettini, is something I've really enjoyed. And if this is a pain that makes him hungrier for success in the future, then at the risk of sounding sadistic, I'm glad he's going through it right now. That sounds horrible, doesn't it? I hope I've explained that sufficiently to not sound like an absolute maniac.
She means it in a good way.
I do.
So Zverev wins this title. I still feel quite empty, really, when I watch his matches at the moment, because I think this is the first big title he's won since the allegations were made against him late last year by his former girlfriend, Dolia Sharipova. Allegations which he, as we know, denies, but which have just, it seems, been left now. We haven't heard anything more of them. But I personally can't really watch his matches without that being there somewhere in my subconscious. And I think he was very impressive over the course of the week, but it's not something that I can completely separate in my mind from what I'm watching. Can you?
No, absolutely not. Look, it's my job to talk about the tennis, and I can talk about the tennis. You know, my job is to ask questions about the tennis, and his tennis was brilliant this week. But on a personal level, do I find joy in watching it? No, I don't. It's an extremely uncomfortable place to be in, and I think not just because of what the allegations are and all of that, but sort of the inertia of the situation of, oh, is this just it now? This is how we have to feel for sort of forevermore about the situation. You're sort of waiting for some sort of, not resolution, but progress or action, something, you know, that I feel a real anxiety and inertia about it all. And I don't think any sort of resolution is going to come about how it should be approached. So we all have to find our own peace with how we approach it, I suppose. I'm sure we'll get some emails off the back of this saying he's won a tennis tournament, just talk about the tennis. Why do you have to mention, you know, we're saying how we feel about it. It compromises how I feel about his winning. It doesn't affect my ability to say he played great tennis this week. He did. He played brilliant tennis this week. He was a worthy winner. And as the rules stand, he is absolutely has every right to be playing on the ATP tour. Do I find great joy in it? No, I don't. It's an uncomfortable situation at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, candidly, I don't know what the best approach is and how to talk about it. We can only do and say what we feel is right. Our job is to report on the tennis, and we can't look the other way and pretend that Zverev doesn't exist, and we wouldn't want to do that. He has every right to be playing, and he's winning, he's playing well. We're talking about that, but neither can we scrub the allegations from our memory. And, you know, we can remind people that they exist. We can remind people that Zverev denied them, and we can remind people where they can read Olya's story and that should be listened to and respected. And I guess I'm most mindful of our tone, I guess, when we talk about Zverev, you know, just trying to keep all that in mind while focusing on his tennis and just not being sort of overly heavy-handed with praise, you know, that we might shower on him. That's kind of the approach I've decided to take, and some people might think that's wrong, but that's kind of just how I feel, and I think you're both the same.
Do you think he's shown anything with this victory that would lead you to believe, like we've talked about with Sabalenka, that there's more on the horizon for him in terms of success?
Look, he was brilliant this week. He has won Madrid before in 2018. I don't think he's shown us anything new or a new level that we didn't know he had. I think he's shown us that the scar tissue from the US Open might have healed a bit. I think he's shown us that he's mentally in a decent place, and you know, there were opportunities for his serve to really fail him this week, for those demons on the second serve, the double faultitis, to really rear its head. And there were moments, you know, he double faulted in the first set tiebreak against Berrettini today, which he ended up losing. And at that point, you thought, oh, it's happening. It's happening. It just, you know, you just had to reach the threshold of pressure and it would inevitably happen. But actually, it didn't. There were a smattering of double faults today, but it was never the landslide and the sort of falling off the edge of a cliff. So I think he's shown us that he's, you know, in a good place. I don't think he's shown us anything new this week that we've never seen before. I think we knew that he had this level in him.
Hmm. Yeah, he basically needs to do that at Roland Garros up against superior opponents to those. I mean, that's not to say he beat Nadal and he beat Thiem, but he's now got to do that there in order to I think for me at least, to make me feel differently about how his prospects are going to be going forward.
And look at the winners we've had, Sabalenka and Zverev. It's a very tricky one to articulate, because I really don't want to take anything away from them. But I don't think we're going to have the same winners next week in Rome. You know, the conditions are a factor in Madrid. How much they're a factor is always going to be up for debate. But those are condition-assisted wins. And that's what's wonderful about tennis, the fact that conditions vary so much, probably more than any other sport. Time will tell. What a boring conclusion to that point I was making.
I always
rely on
that.
Only time will tell.
Indeed. Right, let's rattle through a few more things. Electric line calling on clay, yes or no? We've had it this week for the first time.
I quite like Fox. I like the video replay.
That's not having it.
It's a big no from me. I think it works on hard courts and grass courts, because while it's accepted that there's a margin for error, it's the best evidence you have of where the ball landed. The problem with on clay, you've got direct contrary evidence, which is what you're seeing with your eyes.
But some would say, Matt, that actually what you see with your eyes with the mark can be deceiving, because there's the scatter of the top dressing.
Yeah, I'm sure, but they're very good at reading marks. They've been doing this for years. They know how to read marks. And I think
if they get the wrong mark, that happens.
That, I think, is where technology could be used to identify the mark. Or I'd like to see them use the line judges more. Get the line judges up to point to the mark. I just
like
think
in the 84 final with McEnroe.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Great shout. I'm definitely here for that. They've had a tough year, line judges, haven't they? Let's elevate them. Let's make them the stars of the show. I just didn't hate old Fox 10 as much as a lot of people hated it this week. I don't think it's the perfect solution. I think 1984 style line judges probably is, but
Well,
unpopular opinion, I didn't hate it.
Let us know
Matt
what you think.
Now hates me.
No. Just a difference of opinion. It's all fine. Now, in the men's doubles, we had a hell of a comeback from Horacio Zabias and Marcel Granollers, who lost the first set 6-1 against Nikola Mektic and Domate Pavic, came back and won the title. I think it's the first Spanish player ever to win the doubles title, which is a heck of an achievement from Granollers. So well done to him.
They were chuffed to bits, they were. You wouldn't have given them a cat in hell's chance after the first set. Sam Smith said in commentary, it was barely worth sweeping the court after the first set.
Oh, goodness.
It was that one-sided. And with the scoring system in doubles, no ads, and obviously the match tie break, it's quite rare to get really one-sided scorelines because it is an evener, a leveler. That's what you say, isn't it? That's not a word, evener. What am I talking
evener.
About? It's a leveler. The scoring system is a leveler. So, you know, real marker of how dominant Mektic and Pavic were. And they were aiming for a sixth title of the season, I think. Wow. Mektic, Pavic, I mean, they've just been utterly dominant. So that was a massive win for Granoia Zabaios.
And who won the women's doubles?
Siniakova and Krejcikova.
Oh, yeah, who we talked about earlier this year. That's fantastic.
They were Roland Garros champions in 2018, so you might have to think of them maybe as favourites to go and do that again.
Mm. Oh, we should watch with interest. Now, Rome is coming up, well, it's already underway, isn't it? And there's some great early round matches. I mean, it's just absolutely packed draw. Dan Evans is up against Taylor Fritz as we record it just after midnight. That's coming up in about 7 hours. Winner to play Novak Djokovic in round two. So that could be an Evans-Djokovic rematch from Monte Carlo. Yannick Sinner against Hugo Humbert, winner to play Nadal in round two. Hubert Erkacz against Lorenzo Musetti. Possible Karatsev and Medvedev second round. Blimey, I wouldn't mind that. Djokovic could play Tsitsipas and in the quarters, and Nadal could face Zverev. And in the women's draw, Osaka and Serena in the same quarter. And when we actually looked at the sort of the projected quarterfinals from the draw, absolutely barnstorming it was. However, unfortunately, we're not going to have Bianca Andreescu in the draw because she has decided not to travel to the Italian Open. She said because she was at risk of having to isolate again, even though she'd tested negative following her positive recent COVID test. So, yes, Bianca Andreescu is not going to be playing in Rome.
Is struggling to catch a break.
Yeah, she really is, and it's a shame. Mm. A couple of other bits of news. Two players who've separated from their dads as their coaches. Sofia Kenin recently has decided to do that. She said she'll be forever grateful for her dad's sacrifice and contributions, but is excited to put together a new technical team. Doesn't sound like that's been the easiest thing in the world, really, for Sofia Kenin from the way she's spoken. Caroline Garcia is somebody who's, I think people have been talking, me included, about whether she should try to add to her coaching setup for years. But she's always had her father, Louis Paul, by her side. And she's decided she needs a new approach if she's to win big titles. And she's going to work with the veteran coach, Gabrielle Urpi, who's she's been training with at the Rafael Nadal Academy. She said it was her decision. So it'd be very interesting to see how those two both get along in the next few weeks. So that's pretty much rounds up everything tennis-wise. Mascot time. And we have got an absolutely belting pair of mascots for the week. You might have to correct me on pronunciations here. I'm going to try my best. British short hair cats, Chibi and Stephanos. How?
Well, we're confident about Stephanos, aren't we, pronunciation-wise?
Is that a Tsitsipas
I'd like to think so,
after,
anyway.
Matt?
It is. It absolutely is.
They're beautiful, aren't they? We've got a picture of them here. White, fluffy cats.
Should Petros Tsitsipas be offended that Chibi isn't Petros?
Well, no, I think Chibi's older.
Oh, okay.
Mm. So the next one might have to be Petros, which I'm pretty sure would be the first creature named after Petros Tsitsipas in the world.
I think Petros should be fairly pleased with how things are going really generally at the moment.
Yes.
So we have our own mascots. I have Rogue. All right, Rogue. We had a cracking week. Well done on inspiring me. Matt has got Scouse or Mousel. Catherine's got Zeus. Billie Jean has been down the pub all week, disgracing herself, getting absolutely legless. Billie
She's
Jean
been
King.
Living my best life.
Yeah. So, you know, have a word with Billie Jean, will you? Billie Jean. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer and top bloke. And Matt, shout outs.
Simon Lambert.
All right, Simon.
Like Ricky Lambert.
Like Solihull Simon.
Oh, imagine that combo. Solihull Simon meets Ricky Lambert.
Solihull Simon hit an underarm serve to me the other week.
What a hero.
What was your reaction?
To
was
hit a blinding winner, Matt.
Was he cramping or was it tactical?
Well, he was cramping. He was 6'1", 5'2" down at the time. So you make it that way.
Oh,
it
was a tank.
Who else we got, Matt?
We've got Josh Boehm.
Right, Josh.
Like, how are we spelling that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this correctly. B-O-E-H-M.
Oh, like Lab O-M.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks ever so much for your support, Josh.
Hang on. Not like Lab O-M at all.
We needed something, Catherine. That'll do. Matt, what else we got?
We've got now one of our friends from last year who provided one of our favourite shout-out moments. It is Sally Ann Law.
Oh, me and Sally Ann now, we're mates. She wrote to me, did Sally Ann, after that. And we've become pen pals. So, you know, we're not related, but, you know, we get on.
You could and be.
She's got a cracking name. So there we are. Thank you all for your wonderful support in our Kickstarter, which crowdfunds the Tennis Podcast so that we can produce all these shows at the middle of the night. And yeah, we'll be back again a little bit later in the week on Thursday to look back or to look at what's gone on so far in Rome by that point. Matt, thank you. Catherine's about to yawn. She's just holding it in. And now she's going to go to bed because she's worked very hard this week. Thanks all of you for listening and for your nice words and letters and support, and we will speak to you soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.